Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Generation Y ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today. Listen to a bold new take on George Orwell's classic 1984 on Audible, starring an epic cast with Andrew Garfield, Cynthia Erivo, and Andrew Scott, and featuring Tom Hardy as Big Brother. Plus, a haunting original score by Matthew Bellamy and Elon Ashkari that takes this thrilling production to the next level. Experience an immersive listening experience like nothing you've heard before. This chilling tale of constant surveillance, thought police, and rebellion is more relevant now than ever. Big Brother is watching and listening. Hear why those who control the past control the future. Listen to George Orwell's 1984 on Audible now. Go to audible.com/bigbrother.
There are days like today where I am just too busy to get outside and go feed myself. And that's where DoorDash comes in. It's super convenient, and they bring the food to me. Also, I don't like paying delivery fees, so I have DashPass. DashPass is an exclusive membership from DoorDash that gets you unlimited $0 delivery fees on eligible orders and members-only deals and discounts, all for only $9.99 a month. DashPass actually pays for itself in 2 orders on average. DashPass makes it easy to save at restaurants, grocery stores, and all your local favorites. Open the door to $0 delivery fees and savings you can't get anywhere else. Sign up for DashPass today only on DoorDash and get your first 30 days free if you're a new member. Subject to change, terms apply.
We're brought to you by Audible. Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere while traveling, working out, walking, or doing your chores. I usually listen to Audible when I'm on a plane because it's the best way to keep my mind off the boredom and claustrophobia being in a plane. I'm currently listening to The Long Walk. It was one of Stephen King's first books that he wrote under Richard Bachman. It's an incredible story about teens who are volunteered to go on a long walk. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. Right now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500. That's audible.com/GWP or text GWP to 500-500.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Dive into the chilling new Hulu original series, Under the Bridge, the riveting adaptation of the best-selling true crime book. Based on shocking true events, Under the Bridge tells the haunting story of a murder that lays bare a small community's darkest secrets. Go deep into the hidden world of the town's tormented teenagers as detectives race to solve the sinister crime. Starring Riley Keough and Lily Gladstone, Under the Bridge is now streaming with new episodes Wednesdays, only on Hulu.
How you doing tonight, Aaron?
Oh, I'm doing great, man.
Awesome. How are you doing, Mark?
I'm doing fantastic.
Awesome. Hey, Mark, why don't you introduce yourself?
You bet. My name is Mark Hewitt. I'm a true crime author. I'm the co-author of Charles Manson Behind Bars, the first Manson book to be written from the inside. I'm also the editor-in-chief of Radians and Inches, which is a journal dedicated to the search for the Zodiac serial killer. I'm fascinated with the topic of serial killers and with the person of Charles Manson. And I thank you guys for having me here this evening to discuss these items.
If somebody doesn't know who Charles Manson is, do you want to just give a very brief synopsis of, you know, his childhood or what he's famous for? And then we'll
sure. If
that.
You've never heard of Charles Manson, you are probably living on Mars somewhere. My fascination with Charles Manson is the fact that he is probably one of the most flamboyant, controversial people in human history. If you look at fascinating politicians or controversial sports figures, few people rise to the level of Charles Manson. When I bring up his name among other people, I'm amazed at how some people absolutely love him, some people absolutely hate him, but very few people have no opinion of him whatsoever. I'm sure there are people living in small villages somewhere on the other side of the planet who have never heard of Barack Obama, but who know the name Charles Manson. He's one of the most infamous individuals in history. He's most known for being the cult leader of the Manson family back in the 1960s in California, both Northern and Southern California. For the evenings of August 8 to 10, 1969, he sent a group of his family, his followers, to go and commit two brutal execution-style murders of two whole households. And those were some of the most brutal crimes that have happened in the history of the United States. And when that struck, it just fascinated everybody and was covered day-to-day coverage throughout the media. And then when they were captured several months later, the trial of Charles Manson and some of his followers lasted more than a year. It was at the time the longest criminal trial in California history, and it was the O.J. Simpson trial of its day back in 1970 and 71.
My father happened to be the research lawyer for the judge in that trial, but he never spoke to me about it or gave me any shred of information about it.
Interesting.
Yeah. So I have a connection there, but I never knew about it until more recently.
I wonder if he was trying to shield you from the horror.
Probably, because he was very Mr. Rogers-y.
The photographs of the crime scenes are available on the internet, and they are pretty gruesome.
Didn't they cut the baby out of one pregnant woman?
That was one of the claims. There's pictures of a dead Sharon Tate who is still pregnant. She was about 8 months pregnant. And the followers strung a rope around her neck, threw the rope up over the rafters in the house, and kind of hung her and I believe shot her at the same time.
And the other end of the rope was around another member in the household.
So that's correct.
Kind of a weird, yeah. They were doing something witchy is what.
I believe it was Jay Sebring that the other end was tied to.
Yeah. Charles Manson told him to go out and do these things. He said to do something witchy, like something horrifying, leave something witchy to make a statement. And they left like death to all pigs and helter-skelter and blood on the walls, just all kinds of weird stuff, right?
Correct. Charles Manson himself denies it. He takes no responsibility for anything his followers did. I believe he was smart enough to command other people to do his dirty work for him to kind of insulate himself from the responsibility. But of course, everybody who knows the situation knows that he is responsible. His followers to this day claim, oh, he never killed anybody. He's not responsible for what his followers did. But the truth is, it's hard to separate what he did. And a number of the Manson family members claim that Manson ordered them. He heard them order these executions.
Wasn't it said that he tied up those in the LaBianca household?
That's correct. The following night, four of the Manson family members, led by Tex Watson, killed Sharon Tate and all the people in her house. And then the following night, apparently Manson was unhappy with how violent and how bloody it was, and so he said he was going to show them how to do it. So he took the same four and went with two additional family members. He went into the house himself. This is the LaBianca residence, and tied up Leno and Rosemary LaBianca, and then came out and sent the family members in to finish off the work.
That's pretty involved from where I'm sitting.
He still denies to this day that he has any involvement and that he ever killed anybody.
But it would be on Tex Watson's word, though, that he was involved.
Correct.
This is one of the first questions that I had thought of, which is, how loyal were his people? Because if some of them are trying to say that he was more involved than he claims, is it because they want him to have more credit or because they're turning on him?
It later became turning on him. At the time of the trial, they refused to testify against him. They said they were not responsible for anything, and they protected him incredibly loyally. My co-author came to understand Charles Manson as a combination of a crime boss and a cult leader. And if you understand him in those two senses, you understand what he was overseeing, that he used a lot of cult tactics to draw these family members to him and draw their loyalty. He used drugs. He used sleep deprivation. He used mind control, a number of strategies that are commonly used in cults even today to force loyalty among his followers. He changed their names. He didn't allow them to use their own names. He forced them to sever all ties with their past lives and their past family members and contacts. Anything to break down their will, be subject to his demands only. And at the same time, he kind of presided over a criminal syndicate. He had his family members go out and steal and rob and do whatever they needed to do to survive, and were involved in such things as prostitution and anything they could do to raise a buck. And of course, he presided over it all, so he was the one who controlled all the money.
I'd read some things and interviews about how he would give his family members LSD and not take it himself so he could guide them and reaffirm any of the brainwashing to them. And that always just seems really, shady to me to do that. I mean, when you're on LSD or any psychedelic, you're very impressionable. And for him to guide his people to murder with the use of psychedelics, it's disgusting to me.
Right. Vincent Bugliosi makes that point that he made all the family members take drugs, but if he took some, he took a lower dosage. Linda Kasabian has testified that on the night that she went to do the Tate killings, that she and all the others in the car took some kind of capsule, some kind of white pill that affected them.
Any idea what that pill was?
I don't. There were quite a few drugs that they were known to have taken back then. They took LSD, they took cocaine, marijuana, of course, and I don't know what else they were involved in. Pretty much whatever they could get their hands on, I believe.
I would just guess that it was an amphetamine of some kind or a speed to get them heightened.
You mentioned your co-author. Could we talk a little bit about Willie Mendez?
Absolutely. Let me set it up first. The first book I ever published was a self-help book entitled Yes, I Can Change. And it was it's a fascinating book about human change, human potential, what change means. And so it's a self-help book. And you might say, well, how do you go from a self-help book to writing a book about Charles Manson? But let me tell you how I did that. Back in 2003 and 2004, as I was looking to promote my book, I thought, who would be interested in self-help, who would be positively influenced by a self-help process? And the idea came to me that there are quite a few high-profile criminals in prison across the country, including serial killers, who might be interested and have the time in reading my book and saying something about it and maybe even changing for the good. And so this gave me the idea to write to a number of criminals, and I wrote to people such as Arthur Shawcross, the Rochester serial killer of prostitutes, Kenneth Bianchi up in Washington State, who with his cousin were the Hillside Stranglers, and I wrote to Charles Manson as well. And surprisingly, some of these people wrote back to me and wanted to discuss self-help or wanted to discuss change. Well, I received a couple of letters from Charles Manson, which was quite a shock to me. And in my correspondence with him, he introduced me to a man housed beside him in the next cell named Guillermo Mendez, or Willie. Manson nicknamed him Boxcar because the name Willie reminded him of Boxcar Willie. So Willie and I started to exchange letters, and he started to tell me a little bit about his life with Manson, some of the things that Manson was doing, some of the things that Manson was saying. And I was amazed every time I got a letter from him. So at one point I said to him, you know, we need to collect all of these things. and published them, because some of the stories we were telling, he was telling me, I've never read anywhere. And some of the quotes that he was giving me were things that Manson had said, you know, many years after the killings. Willie began to collect a lot of his sayings, tried to describe the situation of living beside Manson, describe how Charlie spent his days, how he spent his time, what his cell looked like, what Manson looked like. And all of this went into the book that we produced together. I should mention that it's not a pro-Manson book, which has upset a lot of people. Some of his followers have said some horrible things about me because I try to not glorify Manson. At the same time, other people are upset that it's not an anti-Manson book and that I don't condemn Manson. I simply try to tell the story of his life behind bars. It's really Willie's story, and so I edit it and organize it, but it's mostly coming from the words of Willie. Willie himself is probably a lifer. He is in his late 40s right now. He is responsible for a number of activities that got him at least 14 felonies. He's serving something like 68 years behind bars. And even behind bars, he caused a lot of problems and attempted to kill his cellmate at one point. And this all led him to enter into Building 4 of Corcoran State Prison. Corcoran is a California prison. Building 4 on the property is dedicated to – it's a segregated housing unit for special inmates. Anyone who is high profile in California ends up in Building 4. So in that building, Sirhan is housed there, and a number of other high profile. And also the fact that Willie left a gang after he was incarcerated made him a marked man. So a combination of leaving a gang and being involved in such heinous crimes made him end up one day beside Charles Manson.
All right, we need to take a moment for our spot for our sponsor, which, as you know, is Audible, and it's audible.com, where you can pick up one of 180,000 titles to choose from. The book that we're covering Manson tonight, so I wish our author had his book out on Audible, because I'd totally pimp his book, but because it's not out there, we're going to go with Helter Skelter, The True Story of the Manson Murders by Vincent Bugliosi. His book was one of really the definitive Manson books that covered the murders and in trial. Can't recommend it enough. They have a guaranteed return policy. I love Audible. I use it all the time. I have multiple books I'm currently listening to, and it saves my place on each one. I can't say enough good things about that. So if you want a free book, go out to audiblepodcast.com/Generation Y. That's GENERATIONWHY. audiblepodcast.com/Generation Y. Thank you.
Now, you mentioned that he almost killed a cellmate. Wasn't that someone who was a pedophile?
That is correct. The book opens with Willie's tale of how he ended up beside Charles Manson, because obviously you have to do more than get a traffic ticket to end up in Building 4 housed beside Charles Manson. So he was quite a brutal prisoner. He suspected that his cellmate was a pedophile, and together they drank a lot of alcohol one night, and Willie took that opportunity to take out a concealed weapon and attempt to kill him, and almost did.
It's so incredible that alcohol and weapons and everything are so plentiful in that kind of environment. It's pretty locked down.
That was probably the biggest insight for me in working with Willie, is to learn about life behind bars. I was a little bit naive as to what happened. I assume, you know, people are in prison behind bars and guards are watching over everything and that nothing bad can possibly happen. Well, it's far from the truth, because guards are there to protect themselves first and foremost, and guards can be upset with one prisoner or another prisoner, and they can turn their backs and allow a lot of things to happen. I was fascinated to learn how Manson spends his time and how inmates can communicate with one another between cells, how they brew their own prison-made alcohol and do artwork and pursue their music. It's just a fascinating lifestyle.
Yeah, it makes you wonder if that's sort of allowed, like there's a blind eye turn just so that the prisoners are just happy enough, just content enough that they won't start too much trouble.
Well, Willie claimed that some of the guards liked Manson and allowed him to get away with a lot of things and even take revenge on other inmates who rubbed Manson the wrong way. And there was one guard in particular who didn't like Manson and who did some activities to bother Manson and harm him.
Manson actually spent a good portion of his life in jail before and after the murders. So do you know what he went to jail for before the murders?
Oh, yeah, anything and everything. He was an incorrigible young man. By the time he got out just before the Manson murders, he'd already spent about half of his life at one reform school or state prison or local jail or another. When he was about 5 years old, his mother and his uncle were sent to prison, and that made Manson essentially an orphan. He was shuttled around between different families. He was went to different reform schools. But even as young as 12, he was stealing cars. He was involved in armed robbery. A few years later, he got involved in prostitution. He stole cars, took them down to Mexico, or took them across state lines to sell. He was involved in forging checks. Pretty much anything that he could do to earn a buck, he would do. It's quite obvious from looking back over his life that he's a confirmed sociopath, that normal rules of society don't apply to him. And even from a young age, he was able to manipulate other people into doing what he wanted them to do and then benefiting from it.
I heard he cashed a federal treasury check for like $43 and got busted and sentenced to 5 or 10 years for like a $43 check. It was something.
Yeah. Vincent Bugliosi makes that point in the book Helter Skelter, that for some reason Manson had a death wish, or he wanted to be in prison, or he wanted to get caught or something, because it seemed like all of the laws that he broke were federal laws. So instead of knocking over a convenience store where he might have gotten a year or two, he would do something. He would forge a federal check and get 5 years for it, even if it was just a small amount. And he would do things across state lines and ended up getting far more prison time than he would otherwise have gotten.
Isn't this sort of tied into his childhood, though? I mean, I know this is speculation, but if he really didn't have a strong base, strong roots, then perhaps the prison system offered him something he couldn't get on the outside, which is stability.
That's quite possible. In fact, there's word that before being released from prison, before the murders, he actually asked, "Do I really have to leave?" Because he wasn't sure he could survive on the outside. He didn't have the structure that a prison or a reform school would have. And yet every reform school he ever went to, every local prison he ever went to, he tried to escape from. So there was probably a love-hate relationship with the prisons. But regarding his childhood, there's a lot of debate about Manson. He claims that he was abused, and he claims that he came from poverty, and he claims this and that. Whereas his mother, back when she was living in the 70s, claimed that as a child he was spoiled. He was coddled. He was given what he wanted. It's just that he was incorrigible and he went around manipulating other people.
We're brought to you by ZipRecruiter. So the other day, Aaron and I were trying to get concert tickets to a show we really wanted to see. And I waited before I bought my ticket. And guess what? I missed my chance. And that's why you have to act quickly or somebody else will get it instead. It's like hiring for your business. If you want to find the most talented people for your roles, you have to scoop them up before the competition does. So that's why the best way to do that is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify top talent for your roles. And immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. Amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/GenY. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Field of Greens. I like eating healthy, and I've tried a lot of different supplements. I've tried juicing, and I've spent a lot of money and wasted a lot of time. And let me tell you, honestly, none of those things ever made me feel better. With Field of Greens, it's a superfood that gives you nutrition the way nature intended. It's packed full of organic fruits and vegetables, not extracts. And when you're getting those nutrients, you can sleep better, notice things like your hair and your nails, feel stronger, helps with digestion. You just feel better overall. My favorite flavor is the strawberry lemonade. I have a feeling you're going to love this product the way I do. But if for some reason you don't like it, they give you a 100% money-back guarantee. Plus, you can get 15% off your first order and free rush shipping. Visit fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code GenY. Promo code GenY at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com. Go check it out.
So it's hard to say exactly what type of background he had. I have a chapter about his childhood in the book Charles Manson Behind Bars, and it talks about some of the experiences that he had with his mother. And it's hard to say that he was coddled and he had the perfect childhood. But at the same time, a lot of people have had difficult childhoods and have overcome greater obstacles than Manson ever did and didn't turn out the way he did.
Yeah, I think it's a word that you've used, which is contradiction. And perhaps his whole life is full of contradictions.
I suspect so, yes.
One thing I wanted to bring up, I know we're going to get into the prison life here, but he was known for music as well. And I wondered if the guitar was almost like a recruiting tool, that it attracted people to him.
I've never looked at it that way. Okay. I know he himself was very interested in music, and he fancied himself as a rock star and wanted to be as big as the Beatles and wanted to have fame and fortune and money. But he kind of proclaimed himself to others as a guru, with someone with great wisdom. I think maybe he used his guitar playing and singing to entice some people, but it was more his lectures and his drugs and his commune lifestyle that attracted a lot of people to start to follow him. I know that with the Manson family, he had them singing a lot, and maybe he used music as a way to entice them and to keep them part of the group.
Okay.
But he himself wanted to be a rock star, and he was hoping for a recording contract. In fact, that's what brought him into contact with Terry Melcher. Terry Melcher, the son of Doris Day, lived at the home that Sharon Tate was renting. And Manson had contact with him with the hopes that he would record an album for him, and that would be his ticket to fame. Apparently, Melcher said something to him like, yeah, we'll get together sometime and I'll record you. Which Melcher meant to mean, don't call us, we'll call you. But Manson took it quite literally and was waiting for Melcher to call. Well, Manson returned to the home that he knew, where Terry Melcher had been living in the past, and that's where Sharon Tate was living at the time. Her husband at the time, Roman Polanski, was in Europe producing a film, but at the night of the murders, Sharon Tate was home with four others. That's when Manson sent his family members to go there and to wipe out everybody who was living there.
And they actually thought Roman was involved at that time. They didn't realize they were dealing with, you know, cult murderers yet. They thought it was like a drug thing gone wrong, and Roman had something to do with it.
There were a lot of questions in those first few days, because it was such a horrendous crime, and it seemed to be not a whole lot of motive. You know, guns and knives were used. Everybody that they found were executed, including a teenager who was in a station wagon just leaving the property. Stephen Parent showed up at the property to speak to somebody living in the guest house who he'd just met. Stephen was trying to sell a clock radio and called up this guy living in the guest house and showed up there and said, would you like to buy my clock radio? Well, the guy living in the guest house said, you know, no thanks, and sent him on his way. And as Stephen was driving out of the driveway, that's when the Manson family entered And that's when he was shot sitting in his car in the driveway. The original thought in the early fog of the attack was that the guy living in the guest house must be responsible because he was the only one still alive on the property. He claimed not to have heard a thing, and yet five people had been executed around him. He just had the luck of not being found by the Manson family and survived. And then the suspicion moved to Roman Polanski because he was in Europe, and maybe there was a drug connection. Maybe Polanski didn't want to be married anymore or didn't want to have a child, or they really didn't know what was going on. In fact, it sent shivers of fear through the community, wondering if this can happen to such a high-profile home, such a rich home in the gate and behind a locked gate. You know, who is safe? You know, who is the next target?
Manson and his followers are tried for the murders and found guilty. They're all sentenced. Some of them have actually gotten out, and they're the ones that murdered people, whereas Manson still sits behind bars to this day.
Well, all of them who were involved were originally sentenced to death. And only because the Supreme Court overturned the death penalty in 1972 were all of their sentences commuted to life. So by all rights, Manson should probably be dead by now if it weren't for that overturning of the death penalty. The only individual who was involved in the murders and who has been released is a man known as Klemms, Grogan. He was involved in the LaBianca murder. He was paroled a number of years ago. And one of the claims is that he was not that intelligent, that not that bright, maybe has a learning disability and kind of went along just with the crowd to be part of the group, but wasn't really a mastermind behind it and didn't have a lot of malice in what he was doing. And so he is the only one who has actually been paroled. Susan Atkins tried to get released when she was dying of brain cancer, and they wouldn't give her a mercy release, so she died in prison a few years back. Squiggy Frum was not involved in those two nights of murder, but she was convicted of attempting to kill Gerald Ford when he was president. She was sentenced to many years, but she has been paroled. The others continue to try to be paroled. In fact, just recently, Bruce Davis, one of the Manson family members, has been recommended for parole by the parole board, and it all depends on whether the governor is actually going to allow that to continue. But in previous occasions, he has been up for parole. The parole board has recommended him, but the governor has refused to allow it.
And Manson doesn't try real hard to get paroled. I've seen some of his parole hearings.
Yes, he was denied parole a year or so ago. He didn't even go to the parole hearing. I don't think anybody in the right mind thinks that Charles Manson is going to be paroled. What parole board is going to recommend that? Interestingly, though, I do have a chapter to end the book, Charles Manson Behind Bars, on what Manson says he would do if he were ever paroled. But it is a dream because he is not eligible for parole for another 12 years or so. And he is already 80 years of age, so he's not likely to live another 12 years.
Again, your co-author is a prisoner. What I understand is you said that he didn't set out to write the book. You found the stories that he was relaying to you so fascinating that you were compelled to write it, I imagine. But how
I was so fascinated by what he was saying, what he was telling me.
How did he meet Manson? I know you said he was in the same building, but how did it come to pass that they struck up a conversation?
Well, they just happened to be in celled next to each other. In that area of Building 4 is one prisoner per cell. They are sociopathic enough so that they are not able to handle a cellmate, and they talk between cells. Each inmate has what's known as a fish line, which is a string with a weight attached to it, and they use that to send notes and send packages between cells. Well, Manson and Willie, just by the luck of the draw, I suppose, ended up beside one another. And Manson took a great interest in Willie. And they would spend frequently 4 or 6 hours an evening talking to each other between cells. They would position their heads in a certain way toward each other's cell, and they would just whisper by the hour and share stories with one another and talk to one another. It seemed to be a little bit of almost a mentorship, like Manson warmed up to Willie and found Willie to be a very impressionable person. In fact, Willie was tempted to become a follower of Manson's, or at least have great respect and admiration of the man, because he believed a lot of what Charlie told him. And it wasn't until he got moved out of that prison and got away from Manson that he was able to look back and say, you know, a lot of what I was told probably wasn't true and was probably very manipulative. But at the time, he felt like he got very intimate with Charlie.
For lack of a better word, I think Charlie is always the alpha, and he couldn't take somebody else trying to get the spotlight or trying to advise him on anything.
I believe that's absolutely true. My understanding, my dealings with Willie is he's a very friendly, kind person. I believe he probably lacks a lot of self-control, and that he decides to do something and does it and then thinks about it later. And that's probably why he became responsible for the felonies that he did, the attempted murder, the armed robbery, and the whatnot. But in dealing with me, Willie always comes across as a very kind, uplifting person, and I can't see him being any type of a threat to somebody like Charles Manson.
Now, by Charles Manson giving people nicknames, which you say he was wont to do, does that also help with the relationship where he is the alpha?
I never thought of it that way, but quite likely, because Charlie would talk about Willie, he'd call him Boxcar all the time, never called him by his real name. But I don't suppose that's really uncommon, because behind bars, few people use their real names. They have a lot of nicknames.
Right, but Charlie was doing it before. And I also wonder is Willie still going by that nickname today, or is he going by Willie or Guillermo?
I think I'm the only one who calls him Boxcar now. He goes by Willie. He was known by Willie, and as a child he got the name Wino, so he's got quite a few nicknames.
You said that Manson actually wrote you a few times. What was kind of the content of those discussions, and then how did you where do you think he was then, and where do you think he is now?
I think I was kind of crafty when I originally wrote to Manson. He was about 70 at the time, and I thought, you know, what do you write to somebody who gets letters all the time? How can I distinguish myself? And in fact, he is the prisoner in the United States who gets more mail every day than any other prisoner. So I wrote to him, and I just started off my letter by saying, "Dear Charlie, I need your help." And by starting with those lines, he felt compelled to respond to me, because I didn't offer him a threat. I didn't challenge him. I, in fact, wrote to him with great respect. I would love to say that the letters that he wrote me were very insightful and that I learned a lot about him, but I really didn't. His level of education is extremely low, and his ability to carry through an argument is probably even lower. His letters to me tended to be more collections of thought, and one sentence didn't necessarily mean anything about the next sentence, and it was just a lot of verbiage. He talked in contradictions, and he talked in vagaries, and he talked with great strength. I can barely even quote things from the letters to try to be intelligent, but it was still fascinating to receive letters. And of course, my family members were quite surprised to see me get letters with a swastika in the return address in Charles Manson's name on it.
Does he regard the swastika for the Nazi symbol, or does he have a new meaning for it?
I have never heard him discuss the swastika specifically. He originally put an X between his eyebrows and his forehead to make the statement that he was Xing himself out of society, that he no longer wanted to be a part of society. He later added the lines to make it into swastika, and I think he did that just for the shock value. Manson's very much into intimidating and shocking, and the Manson murders certainly portray that, but he's always talking about death. His favorite animals are scorpions and spiders, so anything that he can do to intimidate and scare other people, he likes to do.
And do you believe that his intimidation tactics have anything to do with his own shortcomings? We know he's not a very large person, so perhaps it's his way of protecting himself by being on the offensive.
I caught your pun there, his shortcomings. He's only about 5'2", 5'3". And as such a small boy being in reform school, there are stories about him being raped and sodomized by older boys. Being small and being in prisons and reform schools and whatnot, he had to be strong to survive. And so he is the alpha male's alpha male. He won't let anybody have any control over him whatsoever. He has to dominate by being absolutely in control and absolutely strong. I think that's what impresses a lot of people within the Manson family and impresses a lot of people today. They think he's so confident, he's so strong, he's so powerful. But like you suggest, it has to do with his upbringing and his need to be in control, or else he will be victimized.
Kind of a compensation.
Quite likely, yes. And behind bars, either you're a victimizer or you're victimized. So he chose to be the shark, not the minnow.
But one of the things at play here is before he became the Charles Manson, he might have been in prison. But when he goes back into prison as the infamous Charles Manson, that's a whole new character, is it not? Even though he's not really that different, it's just the entire world now knows who he is. That changes everything, does it not?
Oh, absolutely. And he, behind bars, he embraces his celebrity. Willie was amazed at how people regarded him differently just because he became known as somebody who hung out with Charlie, that the guards started treating him differently, giving him favors and watching out for him. He was amazed at how much Charlie celebrated being a celebrity and was really proud of who he was and who he had become and how everybody knew who he was. In fact, a lot of guards would actually go to Building 4 just to see Charlie. I suspect that he's the most high-profile criminal in the United States today. I don't know who would be more infamous.
Well, I can't come up with any names, so I won't be disagreeing with you.
I'm thinking too, and I really can't think of anybody.
And it's really his personality that carries this. So for many years, one of the, I guess you could say, the primary question in my mind was, he acts so crazy. You know, it's almost like, is he saying something profound, or is it just a bunch of gibberish? Was it all an act, or is this really what's legitimately coming out of him?
You're bringing up a number of questions there. One is his sanity. And I know in the early days he used the crazy act to get what he wanted or to get away from being beaten up as a small man in prison around a lot of large men, large bodybuilders, and a lot of power. The one way that you can respond is by acting crazy, because you never know what a crazy person's going to do. So that was one way that he used to manipulate others or threaten others, by just acting crazy. At the same time, he's been in prison for so long that he is actually been diagnosed with a number of mental illnesses, and he is looked upon as a mentally ill prisoner. But you're right, a lot of it is acting, a lot of it is for show. And then the other question you bring up is you know, what is for show? He's a great promoter of himself. And so if you've watched the times that he has appeared before parole boards or the interviews that he has done with people such as Geraldo Rivera, he's very keen in who his audience is and what he's trying to portray. And he is very entertaining. You got to give him that. He's hard not to watch. You put him in front of a camera and he shines for the camera. He shines for the audience. In fact, Willie makes the point that when he was interviewed by Geraldo Rivera and other people, Manson would claim that he was the one telling people where to put the cameras. He was the one telling people what type of questions to ask and where to guide the conversation. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But I certainly know he wanted to be in charge of every conversation, and he wanted the spotlight on him, no matter the situation.
Take a moment to get a word from our sponsor, Quince. Do you need to upgrade your wardrobe or home essentials at an unbeatable price? Well, Quince has you covered with timeless pieces that never go out of style, and you'll have them in your closet forever. And the best part? All Quince items are priced 50 to 80% off less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman, passes the savings on to you, and Quince only works with factories that are safe, ethical, with responsible manufacturing practices. Along with premium fabrics and finishes, how can you not love that? I recently got a duvet cover and a pair of awesome relaxed jeans. They're stretchy too. You can find all kinds of stuff at Quince. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/GenY for free shipping on your first order and 365-day returns. That's Quince, Quince.com/GenY to get free shipping and 365-day returns. Quince.com/GenY. Today's episode is sponsored by BetterHelp. Some of us spend our lives wishing we had more time, but time for what? If time was unlimited, what would you use it for? If you need to squeeze a special thing into your schedule, do you even know what's important to you and how to make that a priority? Well, with therapy, you can find out what matters to you so you can do more of it. We all need to vent sometimes. We all need to talk about some of the things that have happened to us. And I'll tell you right now, your friends might be sick of hearing about it. So take the burden off them. Let a professional help you. Sometimes it's as simple as just getting something off your back and letting somebody else know so you can feel validated and move on with your life. If you're thinking about starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/GenY today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/GenY.
There's a lot of killers and murderers and horrible people that get married in prison. And just recently, Charlie made it back in the news for, I guess you could call it, an attempted marriage.
That was quite a story. This girl named Star claimed that she was his fiance. It's interesting because she's in her 20s and she's a dead ringer for one of the members of the Manson family. She looked like she walked straight out of the 1960s and has transformed herself into making herself look like a Manson family member from back then as a way of reaching out to him. But she claimed that they were engaged and they were going to get married, and they got a marriage certificate. Well, when Manson was interviewed about it, he said, oh yeah, that's just for publicity. That's just, that's not real. That's just what we're telling people. They did get a marriage certificate. The marriage certificate expired, so they did not get married before the expiration date on that, on the certificate. And then more recently, she has been in the news again. She made the claim that the only reason she or somebody close to her made the claim that the only reason that she wanted to marry him was so that she could receive his body once he died. Now, I've heard of people getting married because of somebody else's body, but never quite like that before.
It appears that she's running his websites and Facebook pages and stuff like that.
Yeah, there are a number of people who continue to surround Manson. They actually live in towns nearby his prison so they can have contact with him. They have been given permission to receive all of his mail so that now they are sorting through his mail rather than him receiving it directly. There are a couple of websites in place promoting Manson's ideas. I'm not sure exactly how Star fits into some of these followers. I know that a number of the followers frequently have falling outs with one another, and they argue and bicker between themselves, which I suppose is to be expected. But some of them are quite true to Manson and want to promote his philosophy of ATWA, A-T-W-A.
Air, tree, water, animals.
Yes.
And this is something he came up with back
Yeah, I don't know exactly when he came up with it or exactly the chronology of how it came about, but he has always promoted himself as an environmentalist, somebody who cares about the environment. How true that is debatable. When anybody says anything negative against him, his knee-jerk response is to say, well, why? How could you criticize me? Look what you're doing. Look what you're doing to the planet. Look what you're doing to the environment. And so that's a bit of a defense. I have a chapter in the book on Atwa that explores each one of those different aspects. Like so much else of Charles Manson, it's hard to say which of it is close to his heart or which of it is just used to manipulate other people. I've spent a lot of time trying to figure out his philosophy of life and try to understand his teachings and his wisdom. A lot of it seems to be just a lot of nonsense. What happens to work in any given situation seems to be what he believes. But he's been influenced by Christianity, by Scientology, by environmentalism, by some Buddhist teaching, and who knows what else. He's had contact with psychiatrists, so there's a lot of psychology mixed in with what he says. But as far as a coherent, clear philosophy of life, it's hard to say that he's really thought through what it is that he believes.
And I heard that Star actually comes from a very conservative religious family, and they're kind of accepting of her relationship with Charlie.
It's an interesting psychological dynamic, that's for certain.
So do you know if she still visits with him at all?
As far as I know, the last I heard that she is still in cahoots with him. What exactly the relationship is, I don't know.
Maybe she's still working on him to get him to essentially sign his body over to her.
They may get married someday. Who knows?
Again, I want to go back to Willie because you stated that much of this book is Willie because it's sort of a filter. As you said, you corresponded with Manson, and it's really difficult to get information from him, cohesive information. And
correct.
Perhaps by working with Willie, who is a prisoner, you could get better information from Manson through Willie. So could you give us an example of a story that Willie was able to relay to you that helped you at least learn something about Manson?
Sure. I guess the strength of my book, Charles Manson Behind Bars, is the fact that it's written from the inside. It's written by Willie, who is housed right next to Manson. But that's also the book's greatest weakness, because Willie is telling me stuff that Manson told him. Well, first of all, you have to believe that what Manson is telling is the truth. And then you have to believe that what Willie is telling me that Manson said is true. So there's a bit of a broken telephone chain there that some things may or may not be true because of the origins of the information. But there's a chapter in my book about different prisons that Manson has spent time in. And Manson told Willie stories about tending a garden out in one of the institutions that he was involved in, that there was a time when the prison guards allowed prisoners to plant gardens and grow vegetables and pass these vegetables around to other people and actually live off some of the food that they were growing. There was a couple of stories that Willie related to me about Manson having conflict with other inmates and how he dealt with these. And sometimes he was very clever in how he dealt with these conflicting situations. Whether these are actually true stories or whether Manson's remembering them differently than they actually happened is a big question. One story that Willie told was about how Manson got very involved in the Native American community behind bars, and that because of his great love for animals and nature, that the Native Americans accepted him as a brother and actually incorporated him into sweat lodges and leadership positions within their community because they had such great respect for him. I thought that was quite fascinating.
Do you think he was more coherent when speaking with Willie as opposed to when he's on the TV and in front of a camera?
I think so. I can't imagine. Well, I can imagine him trying to be the showman in front of Willie, but I can imagine after 4 hours of discussing between bars that Charlie really let his guard down and shared some more personal thoughts and more personal ideas. It sounded to me like Charlie really challenged Willie, challenged his thinking, and asked him provocative questions, and really using the Socratic method to try to draw Willie out and lead Willie in a certain direction. I thought that was very interesting how some of that went.
Yeah, I'm sure that Willie started to really look forward to his conversations with Charlie.
I think so. And I also document in the book some of the falling outs that Willie had with Charlie. They didn't always agree, and sometimes they fought with each other, and they would ignore each other for a couple days. But they always seemed to be able to make up after a few days.
How many years or months were they cell neighbors?
For about a year. I don't know the exact number of months, but it was approximately a year they were together.
And that's actually a good amount of time, because there's not really much else going on.
Well, I was actually quite surprised at how much was going on with Charlie doing his artwork behind prison and corresponding and whatnot.
Right, but I mean, as to say, like, some people go off to work for 10, 11, 12 hours a day, and while he's staying active because of his celebrity, it's not exactly the same as going off to a job. They actually have probably much more time to just sit and talk.
I think you're right, yes.
So you said eventually Willie leaves Building 4. That's the building they're in, correct?
Correct.
And what causes this to happen? Because you said that they had falling outs and that they got along and falling outs, but did something with Charlie precipitate his move, or was it just something within the system, he just ended up getting moved?
It wasn't to do with his relationship with Charlie. Willie is very uncomfortable wherever he is, and he's forever requesting a change to a different prison. And he's been moved all over the state. I joke with him that he gets to see more of California than I do, because he's been to probably a dozen different prisons. He just goes to one for a while and then requests a transfer to another and a transfer to another. And for some reason, the state of California keeps granting his requests. So he has been all over the place. In fact, several years after we wrote the book together, he actually was transferred back to Corcoran and ended up back in Building 4. And he was able to report to me on some of the things that Manson was up to. He was not housed right beside him, but he would see Manson out in the yard. He would see Manson being pushed around in a wheelchair, was able to let me know what he looked like and what he was doing. But he has since left Building 4 for a second time. So he goes all over the place in California.
So he's still got a very strong pull among people. Is there any kind of count for how many followers he claims he has or anything?
Yeah, I have no idea. Okay. I know there are websites and there are people who are fanatic about him all over the world. There are people in Australia who think he's fantastic, and some in Europe who live and breathe the things that he says and the things that he does, but I've never seen any type of count. I suspect that it rises and follows repeatedly. Even back in the 1960s, the number of people who followed Manson kind of rose and fell. Today, people look back and say there were specific members of the Manson family, the hardcore members, but at different times, there were as many as 30 people who would commune with him. Some would stay for a couple of weeks, some stay for a couple of months before moving on, but there was a lot of fluidity.
Does he still call in hits on other people or try to get people murdered?
That I do not know. Okay. I know of nothing about that. I suspect that he would be very quiet about it, and the authorities would be wary of something like that. There was an occasion where he was found to have a couple of weapons in his cell. There was a shakedown of a cell, and they found a several inch long piece of cyclone fence that was sharpened to a point. A sewing needle, a long sewing needle, had been confiscated from him. And I know in one case they shook down his cell and they found two cell phones, that there were some problems that he was making calls outside the prison. And some of these calls have actually been recorded. So he is not an inmate who has any interest in abiding by the rules. He gets regularly punished for different things that he does behind bars. I know of no murders that he's been accused of, or attempted murders, or ordering any murders.
I know this might be heading off subject a little bit, but considering how this all went for you, you initially started by contacting different serial killers or infamous murderers, or in Charlie's case, a cult leader. Does this lead you to want to reach out again and see what happens? It's almost like you were playing the crane game and were unsure of what you were going to end up with.
I'm not sure the reference to the crane game.
Well, sometimes when you drop the crane down, you're hoping for one thing, but you end up with something else. And in your case, you didn't even expect Charlie to write you back because of how popular he is. So you sort of got lucky there, but you ended up with Willie. Willie's the one that you really ended up with. That's what the book is about, essentially, is Willie and yourself corresponding about Manson. So
correct. It really is Willie's story that I wrote, yes.
Yeah, I didn't know if contacting other killers or people of that sort is something you'll be doing again to see if something else develops, or if you just have other books planned. And so
I don't have any other plans at this point. Any of the other inmates that I've written to, I've either received nothing back or something back from the person that I wrote to. Manson may be an unusual case where, because he receives so many letters, oftentimes he passes these letters on to those who are housed around him. In fact, I have a chapter in the book about the type of letters that Manson receives and how he sorts them and what he does with them. Willie had a unique opportunity to kind of look over the shoulder of his neighbor to learn the type of mail that he got, and his reaction and his thoughts about the different type of mail that he got and what he did with it. A lot of the mail he received ended up becoming part of art projects, because he would retain the cardboard or the pulp paper. Other letters, depending on who wrote him, he would write back or not write back, or make fun of the people that wrote back to him. Manson was always amused when somebody would write him and say, I think I'm your long-lost love child. This person would be in their 20s or 30s, and Manson would realize from the calendar that he hadn't been with a woman in the last 50, 40 years or whatever, and that obviously this wasn't his love child. But there's some fascinating types of people that wrote him, or types of mail that he received.
You were writing these murderers, whether they be serial killers or just infamous murderers. Do we consider Manson a mass murderer, a serial killer, or?
Well, I've run into a lot of problems calling him a serial killer in the past, because he certainly doesn't fit the typical definition of a serial killer. It's not to say that he hasn't killed people, because there are other people that have come within his orbit that he either tried to kill or maybe actually did kill himself. And these are beyond the two nights of killing. Death certainly surrounded Manson and the Manson family. There are quite a few other unconfirmed deaths that they don't know how these people died, or people disappeared. A lot of people who had connections to the Manson family ended up dead. Now, how exactly that happened isn't clear at this point. Some people have called Manson a serial killer. As I said earlier, Willie kind of came to the conclusion that he was a cult leader / crime boss. And, you know, crime bosses are very responsible for murders within their organizations, because they order murders, or they have people rubbed off for one reason or another. They're still looking for bodies. In fact, as recently as a few years ago, they were out looking at, I believe, the Barker Ranch out in Death Valley, looking to see if there were bodies buried somewhere. So it's quite possible that Manson did himself kill three or more people with a cooling off period in between, which would qualify him to be the definition of a serial killer. but he certainly doesn't fit the mold of a Ted Bundy or a John Wayne Gacy or somebody like that.
So in other words, you're holding open the possibility that he is. We just can't technically label him as such because we don't have definitive proof.
That's a good way of explaining it, yes.
When you started, you were kind of giving him a couple of labels or so because he isn't so simple a person, hence why he's so infamous.
He is a very complex person, that is for certain. He's a fascinating psychological study. He's been diagnosed with quite a few different mental illnesses or mental traits. I feel quite comfortable that in the diagnosis of him being a narcissist and a sociopath, you know, who knows what else he is responsible for, or who knows else what he's capable of.
To finish up, why don't you again give the title of your book and let people know where they can get it and in what forms?
Absolutely. The book is entitled Charles Manson Behind Bars. It's by myself, Mark Hewitt, and my co-author, Guillermo E. Mendez, or Willie Mendez. It is available in soft cover or in ebook format. And if your local bookstore does not have it, they can order it, or it can be ordered on iTunes or Amazon.com or many other online outlets.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Mark. It's really informative, and I actually learned some things about Manson tonight that I never knew before.
Well, wonderful. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Just a reminder, if you want to listen to it, Audible has it. With over 180,000 titles in virtually every genre, you'll find what you're looking for. Get a free audiobook and a free 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audiblepodcast.com/Generation Y. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Generation Y podcast ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.